In our continuing series on the three religions, Judaism, Christianity and Islam, I'm delighted to welcome back into the studio Canon Tony Hurl, the vicar of St Paul's Church in Fleetville. Welcome, Tony.
Welcome. It's great.
You're going to talk first about the idea of love. Am I right to call it an idea?
Yes, although it's got real substance because God is love. So the amazing thing, God's got all sorts of characteristics. And the really important thing for Christians is that love is the preeminent one. And you get a different shape. If you put power at the top, as you do with Islam, actually that makes a difference. So whereas God is almighty and God knows everything and God's creative, the thing that it says in Scripture is God is love. And, you know, the Beatles song talks about all you need is love. And in a way, they were perhaps young and might be sort of romantic haze, but there's a story in the Bible that one of the oldest disciples in his old age, and I imagine him leaning on his Zimmer frame, the Apostle John, saying, actually, all you need is love. And so it is true. Love is central. And the wonderful thing for Christians is that God is love. And in a way, that's not in the bag, is it? We could have a God where it was about power or honour or his interest or whatever. But what the Christians say is that the heart of the gospel is that God is love.
Now, there are different terms in the Greek version, and I think possibly in the Hebrew as well. There are different words for love. Love comes from various different terminologies, isn't there? What is this meaning of love, this particular love?
Well, all of them are, in a sense, part of God. But if you want the word that is used for that is agape love. And agape love is where the love for the person is sourced in the one doing the loving. So the nearest we probably think of in English terms is mother's love. You know, you can get into all sorts of trouble. You can cause all sorts of pains, but your mum still loves you. Is that sort of picture. And why does she love you? Because she loves you, not because you're lovely.
And that's how you view
God. And the bottom line of God's love is that he loves us because he loves us, because that means we're secure. But God also loves us because he likes us. And that's how we can be friends with God, because friendship love is another type of love, but it's built on that fundamental chassis of God loves you because he loves you. And that's a bit like in married love. I mean, when you have marriage, you have a covenant. The covenant is, I'm choosing to love you whatever you're like. But obviously, marriage, if it's just that, is hard work, but it's secure. So you can be faithful to someone, in for better or worse, sickness and health, whatever. But the experience of love is much warmer and richer than that. And I picture it, as I say, like a chassis of, a sofa. You have a good chassis so it holds together. But then you have the cushions on top, which is need love, sexual love in marriage terms. And God enjoys our company. So it's not just this austere, whatever you're like, I love you. It's a passionate love of caring for you and enjoying you. So he wants us to be part of his circle. The amazing thing of Christianity is that God so loved us while we were sinners, while we were alien and enemies of his, but he wants to make us friends. And more than friends, he wants to make us joint heirs with Christ. And so the idea is that we're caught up into the relationship, the same relationship as Jesus had with the Father. So the scale of love is amazing.
But that relationship between Jesus, between the Son and the Father, is at times quite a difficult one, because I'm not thinking of the why have you
forsaken me,
but also I'm thinking back through the whole of the Bible, if you like. God is sometimes very angry, very frightening, shows himself in various ways that could be deemed to be terrifying. How does that work?
Firstly, I think that if you're talking about a relationship with Jesus, I think, and some Christians would disagree with this and some songs don't say this, but I think the Father was still looking at the Son when the Son took all the weight of the sin of the world. He was separated from the Father by the weight of sin. He took our separation. But I don't think the Father was separated from him. Okay. And that's why if you look at the Passion film, a teardrop falls from heaven at the height of when he's dying. Okay. Because I think God, and that's why it's not cosmic child abuse. It's because it's the Father himself suffering every bit as much as the Son. But the Son is achieving salvation for us.
Okay. Is this the same Father as the Father of the Old Testament?
Yes, I believe God is the same. Now, I think that when you look at the Old Testament, there are difficulties with, for instance, ethnic cleansing. Why did the Jews have to live in a separate area where it was cleaned out? Now, I think that's a real problem. Suffering is a real problem for Christian theology. And in the end, you have to say, I think that we don't understand it and that Jesus entered it. So we have a God who knows what it's like to feel like. There is a meaninglessness about suffering. But I think the second thing I want to say is that suffering and sin has entered in through the devil, not through God's plan.
What do you mean by the devil?
What I mean by that is that we chose in the story of the fall to reject the idea that God was good. So the story is set that the devil tempts Adam and Eve and says, this fruit you shouldn't eat. If you eat it, you'll be like God. So it's to doubt God's goodness. And that was the one they bought. And that's original sin. And we're all born sinners. You know, you take a lovely little child and you think, aren't they beautiful and aren't they perfect? Well, they are sort of perfect, but you don't have to teach a child to be selfish or to, you know, we have original sin in us. And the original sin is to doubt the goodness, first of all, of our parents and also of God. So when you tell a child who you've loved dearly not to do something, they don't say, thank you so much for helping me, you know, that I would have hurt myself, do they? They suspect you of cheating them of something that would be good for them. That's original sin, a bias against the goodness of God.
Whether you're taking the Garden of Eden literally or as an image, as a picture.
As a story with the truth.
You're saying that the relationship there between Adam and God was a loving
relationship.
Adam didn't have much to do with it because he was presumably at a learning stage, as it were, but God
was...
Well,
I think it was perfect fellowship. And I actually think that Adam and Eve were sent into the world, to subdue the earth. So I think that in the Christian doctrine of the fall, the idea of the devil, who's a fallen angel, takes off the world in rebellion, that Adam and Eve were put there as the first Adam and Eve to bring the earth back into relationship with God. Now, there is a sense in which in a marriage, if your partner is going down the road of an affair, it is right you're angry. And it is right that you stop that. And it is right that if they go on, it will wreck it. So there is an anger and a jealousy of coming out of this love. It's not just a whatever you like. It's not a sugar daddy love. It's a real love. And that's what I think you eavesdrop in behind the protests of the prophets as to how the people were going, is don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. But if you turn back to me, though your sins are scarlet, they shall be white as snow. So there's the promise of restoration.
You can pick that up at Noah, Moses, at Abraham, yes. Each of the key.
And indeed, Noah, the judgment comes because the thoughts of people's hearts were only evil all the time. So it's so bad that judgment is right. And indeed, the difficult story of the conquest of the promised land and the order to clear out everyone in it. Very interesting, Abraham wasn't given the promised land because the evil in that land was not yet full blown. And they were doing child sacrifice. Now, the Old Testament is predicated on the fact that sin was contagious. So I picture it like foot and mouth disease for cattle. When we had a foot and mouth disease outbreak, the vets had the strange work of killing lots of cattle. Now, that wasn't what they signed up to be a vet for, but they were doing it, and we don't think they were bad vets doing it, because there was no cure. So in the Old Testament, there was no cure against sin. Sin was contagious. And that's why when Israel was set up, it was set up to be an enclave where God
was honoured. And you're
talking
about the Old Testament, Israel.
Yes. Israel was set up in the Old Testament to be an enclave where anyone could come in. So foreigners were welcome, but they had to leave their gods outside. So it was to be a holy place dedicated to God. Now, in the New Testament, when Jesus comes, holiness becomes contagious. So in the Old Testament, if you had a sinner or a leper, you had to keep away from them. So they had to, for social reasons and for, if you like, spiritual reasons, there was a warning sign put on them. And often that's how people, you know, they don't want their kids to be friends with the wrong type of kids, because there is still a contagion level. But actually, in the New Testament, what Jesus brought was holiness was contagious. So he touched the leper and the leper got healed. And he welcomed the sinner. And that was really offensive to the people who'd been trained that sinners were dangerous.
A lot of this is images, almost, I don't want to use the word metaphor, but images is probably the nearest I can get to it, which help you to understand something. I mean, or are you saying these things actually happened at certain points?
Oh, I believe they actually happened, like Jesus touched lepers. Yeah. But they are also images. I mean, in the sense, whenever you deal with God, it's bigger than you can get. So if you're thinking of what's God like, Scripture would pile up image upon image to point beyond any one of those images to something greater. So he's a rock. Well, he's not a rock, but there's something rockness about him. And so what love is very difficult for us to comprehend.
And is evil the opposite of love? Or is there evil in love?
No, I believe evil is alien to love, but it's not. When God reigns supreme, the devil is only a created being, not equal with God. So it's not dualism, if you want the technical term. in a sense, God is supreme. But love, in a way, is a very powerful weapon, but it's a weak weapon. So I remember there was a lovely African bishop called Festo Kivenjeri, who was in Idi Amin's time when he had his reign of terror. And he pictured his great friend, the archbishop, was killed, martyred by Idi Amin. And he pictured himself sitting opposite Amin and being given a gun and having to give the gun to Amin and saying, that's your weapon. My weapon's love, but it often hurts the one who holds the weapon. And that's the story of the cross, that God so loves us that he's hurt by the sin of the world, but it is redemptive and it can open the way through. Whereas meeting violence with violence, you may win, but you win the battle, you don't win the war. And God's about winning the war. And that's a messy business, mainly with the pain taken on the one who's doing the loving.
I mean, I suspect we'll come back to the centrality of that. If I call it the crucifixion, yes. But I mean that part of the whole process very frequently. Let's stick with love for a minute. Somebody once said to me that actually you couldn't love other people unless you loved yourself. And I struggled with that for a while. I sort of feel there's a truth in there somewhere.
Yes, and Jesus in the two summaries of the commandments, he says, is love God with all your heart, mind, soul and strength. Love your neighbour as yourself. And if you don't love yourself, you can't love your neighbour properly. So it's...
Go a bit further on this, because you can love yourself so much that you exclude everybody.
Well, there's a right love. There's a right love of yourself and there's a narcissistic love of yourself. What we're talking about here is a right love of yourself. So you care for yourself. You treat yourself with value because God values you. But obviously there's a selfishness which is often born actually of not knowing yourself. So it's very interesting. Jesus, when he knew all things had been given into his hands, was when he took up a towel and washed the disciples' feet. So it was almost because he knew he was loved, he could give away his status and his... And you find that people who have in their identity know they're loved, if they're secure, they actually can give. If they're insecure, they have to grab. So it's interesting in terms of attachment theory and Bowlby and people like that, that if you have a secure attachment with your parent, you're set up for life because you know somehow you're loved, and a human being needs to know they're loved to be able to be restored. Now, that's human psychology. What happens, though, if you haven't had that, is that you need to embrace the divine love, because behind every parent is the Father, and the Father's love is redemptive and able to change you so you can become a secure person if that hasn't been your birthright on earth. But we're like buds of a flower, which love opens us, and without that investment of love we can't function ourselves.
One of the couple of things you were saying there that made me think immediately of family context, because of you've talked about the child within the family several times in what you've said. If you go back not that long ago, let's go back to the 19th century, the family would meet together and pray together, read the Bible together, often in a quite aggressive context. I mean, some of those families were not very nice to be in, but that was for external reasons rather than spiritual reasons. But that is not gone away completely, but there are far fewer families who would say, well, we naturally work together as a Christian family, because it's simply not the majority opinion. Yep. Anymore. It's not the majority faith. How do you overcome that? Because that means that generation by generation, the children are not getting that sort of understanding of a relationship.
I think there are pluses and minuses down history, as it were. So I think Victorian family, actually often the father modelled, you do what I say. So it was an obedience was required, but wasn't modelled. Whereas I think the godly pattern is that the father models obedience to God, so the child catches it and does obedience to the father en route, as it were. So the submission modelled. So I don't think the Victorian model was brilliant. I think it was good in parts and bad in parts. Now, the Victorian model didn't care for children particularly, so you could be sent to hospital and not visited. Whereas Bowlby's work on attachment theory has changed how we treat children. But I'm perhaps being a bit provocative here, but I do think that the Industrial Revolution tended to rob families of their men, and I think the Women Working Revolution has tended also to rob children of their mothers often, so that in the old days women were often very unsatisfied because their men were absent and they didn't get much loved by them, because the danger of us men is we're selfish and don't love, but they felt the pain. I think sometimes now it's easier because you can have careers and all the rest of it, but it's actually the children who feel the pain. So I think in our society we've got a lot of problems with young adults and children who've grown up who haven't properly attached for all sorts of good reasons. And I've got children who are trying to buy houses, and how do you get a house without mortgage to the hilt, and then you don't have limited choices? But attachment theory and things like that would actually point to the importance of the first 3 years, whereas maternity leave is a year. So I think I'd love to see a revolution in policy and the budget.
A family that has no Christian faith, can it be a loving environment in your terms? Come back to love all the time. This is your concept of love.
And yes, I believe it can, because we're all made in the image of God. And so there are lovely, lovely people who aren't Christians. Now, if you said to me, where does their love come from? I think it comes from God. And I think this country has benefited massively from its Christian past. So the danger of hurt is that hurt people hurt people. So once hurt gets into the regime, you often then have serial hurt. And then you have shining stars who rise out of some difficult families. But often the process is it ricochets and spreads. And I believe forgiveness and knowing God's love can break that chain. But that can come through the church formally. It may come actually outside it, because sometimes the church isn't all that good at doing it either. But I think they need an encounter with love. And it may be individuals, it may come. I knew a kid once who it's the love of their dog, I think, which helped them change. So I think God is always working inside and outside the church to help people know his love.
And to you as a Christian, the concept of witness, that what you're trying to do is to witness out in the wide world, in everything you do, the love that you sense, that you feel.
Yes, I mean, and that would be true for Jews too. When Abraham was, he was blessed to be a blessing. Now, sometimes they forget that, just like sometimes the church forgets that. But the idea is that you pass on, and we are forced for good in the world, and you care for your neighbour, so you love your neighbour as yourself. And Jesus told the story of the Good Samaritan, so your neighbour isn't the nice person you've chosen, but the Samaritan, who in their day was the sort of, you know, perhaps in our culture, Syrian refugee, or actually the neighbour you don't like. So it was much wider, much more challenging than people like you.
So the challenge in, and perhaps if I can call the current society that we live in, is not a Christian world in the same way that it was in previous times, although it's heavily influenced by the tradition of Christianity. The number of people going to church is smaller. The number of people professing Christian faith is smaller than it was, percentage-wise. But do you see any optimism that there is still room for love, that love comes through?
Well, I do. And I also think sometimes the church is perhaps leaner and fitter, because the reason you go to church now is not for society reasons or for business reasons. It's because you believe it, because there's so many other competitive forces. So sometimes the church, when smaller, I think the church in China, for instance, even though it's under oppression, is a major force. So people see the love of God then. But I think God works inside and outside the church. But it's almost like you can't get the full deal without Jesus. There's an interesting story in the Old Testament of Joseph and his brothers. And, you know, the brothers sell him into slavery and are nasty to him. And he, I think, meets with God and is transformed. And it's a hard old process, but God gets him to a point when he can cope with power. And he ends up heading up Egypt and being a place where they can go in their famine. When his father dies, the brothers think, oh, no, now we're copied. You know, he's been nice to us while the father's alive, but now we're copied. So they hadn't fully understood forgiveness. But there's a bit in that story where it's funny how Joseph treats one brother with favouritism and gives him more food. And I used to groan at that and think, oh, surely favouritism's rife in the family. Why does he do it? But someone helped me to say what he was doing was testing the brothers. When there's favouritism, and he'd been subject to favouritism, and you'd wanted to kill him, with the other brother, if I'm favouritism to him, does that get the same thing out of you, or have you learnt? And the truth was, the brothers had learnt. Because when he was favouritism to Benjamin and said, oh, I'll lock Benjamin up in prison as a test for them, they said, oh no, lock us up, that would bring my... So they had learnt, but they didn't fully know they were forgiven. So when the father died, as I say, they were rocked by that. So I think to get the full download of the love of God, you need Jesus. But God is ministering outside the church, and without Jesus you can get it.
Okay, we're going to come to Jesus in much more depth next time. Thanks very much for today. We'll come back on Jesus specifically. Thanks, Tony.
Great.